from an investment standpoint, when you're young and you're new into the industry, there's this huge focus on like technical proficiency. How well can you model? How well can you understand the balance sheet? But the difference between somebody that's at the 80th and 90th percentile is not that much value add. The thing that makes people great investors, great capital allocators, is people who know how to nurture their curiosity and people that are willing to have and articulate a differentiated view of the future.
Hi, I'm Gordon Lamphere, and welcome to the Real Finds podcast, the podcast that interviews key entrepreneurs, activists, and researchers shaping real estate and, as a result, our world. On today's podcast, we'll be speaking with Hunter Hopcroft. Hunter is a director at a large asset manager focused on REITs and real assets. Before that, he developed several exchange-traded strategies and indices focused on REITs. Hunter began his career as an analyst and an allocator to private alternatives for several RIAs. He's a writer at Lewis Enterprises, a Substack which covers REITs and the asset management industry at large. On the podcast, we discuss the evolution of alternative investments, the nuances of evaluating public versus private real estate investments. We take a deep dive into the risk rewards of industrial and office REITs and uncover structural challenges to the investing world of data centers. If you're interested in the public or private real estate investing world, this is a must listen.
Hunter, thanks for hopping on the podcast today.
Gordon, thrilled to be here. I think we were connected by our mutual friend, Scott Robinson, who's a great guy who I've gotten to know pretty well over the past few years. So I'm excited to be here.
So before we get into real estate, I wanted to start with an interesting topic that is also how we relate. So I know I have a cousin who went to Hampton, Sydney as well.
Oh, wow.
And so, yeah, which is a very small college. So what got you started in real estate, going from Hampton, Sydney, and kind of moving into the world of real estate and finance?
Yeah, so I mean, for listeners that aren't familiar with the name, it's a very old, very small, actually all male college in Virginia that is very liberal arts focused. Which will actually I'll have some tie-ins later to, how that I approach to investing. I was one of those people that went to college knowing that I wanted to do something in asset management, something in investing. So when I came out, I got hired by an RIA in Richmond, Virginia. And this was 2010, 2011 era. So we had just been through the great financial crisis. And there was a big focus on alternatives and alternative investments, which we can maybe get into putting tighter definition around. We're starting to come down market into that ultra high net worth and high net worth market. And so my first job was really going through kind of one of the first or second vintages of things like non-traded REITs, oil and gas partnerships, things like that. And, you know, those early iterations of alternative investments were not great. They were pretty bad. And at the time, I was like, this is not what I thought an investing job was going to be. I was like reading all of these docs, I was going through prospectuses. In hindsight, it was a great experience because it kind of showed me, I learned where the bodies were buried early in my career and things like this. And so it really did that experience, even though when I was right out of school, I was like, this is not what I expected. I've come to really appreciate that experience going through and reading the docs, actually understanding what's going on in these structures.
So talking about understanding things, what is an alternative investment? Because, I think there are plenty of listeners that do understand that are listening right now, but there's probably one or two that might be curious kind of how you would define that.
Well, I'll try not to let my own cynicism steep too much into this conversation, but something that the asset management industry loves to do is find a term that is in vogue or has some momentum and then basically stuff a bunch of stuff they were already doing underneath that umbrella to kind of benefit from the brand halo of alternatives or whatever. But I think, so the sort of classic definition or the definition I think most people apply is basically private markets, whether that's private equity, hedge funds, private real estate, things like that, that anything that's not publicly traded basically gets thrown into the alternatives bucket. I would propose that a better way to think about it is sort of going back to what David Swensen at Yale called low correlation to those other things and low exposure to various other economic factors. So if we take private equity, for example, using a lot of leverage to buy a small company is not necessarily an alternative investment. There's a lot of highly leveraged small caps trading on the public market. If a sponsor comes to me and wants to buy a 300-unit garden apartment in the Sun Belt, it's private, but I don't know if that's really necessarily an alternative investment, you know, relative. Now, there are true alternatives. I remember at various points in my career looking at funds that were buying music royalties or purchasing firefighting planes to lease out or container ships. And to me, those things are kind of quote unquote true alternatives because whether or not someone needs to lease the firefighting planes has nothing to do with the level of the 10-year treasury. And that's kind of what you want in that alternative bucket. Now, of course, alternatives, practically speaking, for most people, cover a lot wider swath, including things like REITs, including things like business development corporations and other things that are broadly alternatives because they're not sort of vanilla, for lack of a better term, equities and fixed income. And of course, you know, the alternative du jour of private credit today. So
how does one end up evaluating like an alternative investment? I know that's something that you focused a lot of your career on. And to me, I'm a real estate guy. So it's, you know, the 10-year treasury does matter. how do you evaluate an alternative investment?
Well, you know, not to get too academic with it, but, you know, it really does all come down to cash flows, just like any investment, just like a real estate investment. What's the source of those cash flows? How high a fidelity do you have on them? You know, for a piece of property, you have leases that, you know, lay out what your likely cash flows are for some time. For other alternatives, you know, again, like private equity, that's not sure. And then I think the other big part of it, which is the much harder part of it, is trying to figure out what you're actually exposed to, what economic forces you're actually being exposed to by allocating capital there. I mean, I think to focus on the real estate side, especially through this last cycle, there's a lot of stories of sponsors who have purchased, let's say, multifamily assets and executed their business plan very well. They've grown rents and they've grown NOI, and that value add has been completely subsumed by a move in rates and an expansion of cap rates.
Yeah.
And it's really important when you're looking at alternatives, especially if they're private or illiquid, to have a really strong understanding of what bet you're actually making, you know, and to know the game you're playing really well and know where those risk factors lie. And I think that's really the harder part of it than coming up with to doing the due diligence and checking the underwriting is trying to figure out what you're actually getting exposure to and making sure that's something you want exposure to.
So how do you go about, you know, evaluating the public versus private risk reward? Because I think that there's a lot of people that sit there and say, you know, one is better than the other. And a lot of that tends to be people tend to either look as a grass is greener perspective, or they look and say, you know, hey, I'm in this section and you should come invest with me of the market. Where do you see kind of that public risk reward play out and private versus public markets?
Yeah, we'll keep the focus on real estate because I think it's probably the most salient and kind of easiest to understand. I mean, I kind of had this, I had always tracked REITs as part of my job, one because of their public disclosure. They're a great way to keep a pulse on various markets. You know, as public companies, they have to disclose a lot. And so if you're looking at private deals, it's helpful to look at what's going on in REITs to understand those markets. But especially through that 2021 era, when I was looking at a lot of private deals for kind of a family office, and again, it would be a 200 or 300 unit garden apartment in the Sun Belt. And I would take the sponsor's assumptions about rent growth and expense growth and overlay them with what was available in public markets. And I say, if this sponsor is right about the growth of this market, the price per pound I can pay in public markets is so dramatically lower than this acquisition. Now, I'm not saying that he's necessarily right about his underwriting assumptions, but if he is, then these are a way better option. Now, the pushback you get, and I think this is like a good opportunity for maybe some like myth busting in this. One is that private is less volatile than public markets. But we all know that that's kind of purely illusory. Yes, the equity in public markets is marked every day, but the leverage that public REITs use is typically much lower than private. So if you have two assets, kind of like-kind assets, and the private asset carries more leverage than the public, in reality, the equity of the private one is actually much more volatile because it's a much more highly levered position. Yes, you can't log on to the computer and see the volatility, but it doesn't mean it's not there. And typically, depending on what index you use, public and private real estate returns basically reconverge about every 5 years. They kind of go apart and come together, go apart and come together. And it's in the going apart. It's in the going apart where public begins to dramatically underperform private. There's a tremendous opportunity for an arbitrage where you can cash out of your private investments and buy public investments and wait for the convergence to happen. You know, you saw this really publicly with BREIT. When BREIT had all those redemptions, you know, you're looking at two lines on the screen, a BREIT NAV that's just, you know, steady eddy up and to the right, and a public REIT that has public REIT index that has sold off 20-30%. Now you can't short BREIT, but if you're in BREIT and you're telling me if you're gonna give me my money back at that NAV and let me take that cash and go buy public REITs with it, I'll take that trade all day, and that's exactly what happened. The other pushback I get a lot on the private market, private versus public, is that private has this legion of tax benefits that are so amazing for you as an investor. But in reality, REITs have absolutely all of the same tax benefits that private does. It just happens at a layer above your dividend. So a REIT gets bonus appreciation. A REIT can do 1031s. A REIT can participate in opportunity zones. All of those tax benefits just happen at the corporate level before your dividend is paid out. So I guess maybe there's an argument that if you're an ultra high net worth person with a lot of K-1 income you need to offset, maybe there's some benefit to private. But again, I don't know that it's really a direct trade-off because you're probably taking a lot more risk than you'd realize. And your returns, I think, over time will more than, or rather, your foregone returns will more than offset the tax benefit you're receiving from being directly invested in private.
Yeah. Look, I think as somebody who works for a private real estate company, I think that there's a very underperceived risk that's associated with investing in real estate, as you mentioned. And I fully agree that I think the biggest advantage to public versus private is, you know, one is scale and one is you have maybe more flexibility for getting in and out of deals. And that's really the only substantial difference that I see between the two. In terms of going through and looking at other, you know, issues of where we don't perceive reality correctly. I'm curious, what are you seeing right now in industrial? Because we're living in this world where, like, there's so many people all in on industrial, as I've started to hear phrases like, you know, it's a certainty that it'll keep going up and up, which is always the, like, you know, the worry that we see in the market. I'm curious, what are you seeing from New York in terms of just the industrial market generally across the United States, and kind of like a reality versus perception?
You know, real estate's a really interesting category, because there's an inclination to want to talk about these things as monoliths. People talk about the office market's terrible. Well, the office market's everything from One Vanderbilt next to Grand Central Station all the way to, you know, a 4-story low-rise brick building in suburban Arkansas. Those are both offices, and we can't really talk about them like they're the same thing. And industrial has very much, you know, if you're an outsider or you're someone a little bit more removed from the market, you think industrial, got it, metal boxes, you know, along the highway. But in reality, there's a lot of asset specificity to those, whether that be ceiling heights, the level of ingress, egress for trucks. You know, there's all these sort of factors that go in. It's really hard to talk about industrial as a monolith. And I think over the past 24 months, you could broadly say the industrial market has been strong, or you could make an argument that it's been weak, but that would gloss over a lot of really important details beneath the surface. So
let's dig into the details, right? So in terms of that, one of the sections of the market that I think has done pretty well, at least over the last 10 years, is like distribution and logistics.
Right.
And so I'm curious, what are you seeing in that market right now, and kind of maybe potentially going forward?
Yeah, it was really fascinating in 23 and 24. So there's sort of East Coast ports and West Coast ports. If we talk about sort of port logistics to give us some sort of, you know, framework to work on, you can imagine, you know, West Coast ports, that's where most of the cheap goods from China come in. You know, it's really, that's predominantly union labor. And the dock workers are represented by different unions on the West Coast and the East Coast. And when the West Coast union workers contract was coming up, they didn't go on strike. They did maybe what you could call a soft strike. They like wouldn't stagger lunch breaks. They just slowed things down. They didn't outright strike. They just sort of push their leverage in sort of less obvious ways. And as that was going on, and if you're a big retailer, you know, we've had 2 decades of hyper-optimized supply chains, you know, where things are delivered just in time, inventories are kept very low, big retailers like Target, you know, squeeze every little bit out of working capital. So if you're one of these big retailers, this slowdown happening on the West Coast ports, if you're a Foot Locker or something, and now your inventory is 2 to 3 weeks behind, we're talking millions and millions of dollars. And so in response to that, as that played out, people started figuring out, you know, the global economy is very flexible and fast. They started shifting a lot of that to East Coast ports, or at least diversifying to East Coast ports. And then as soon as they did that, the East Coast dock workers contract came up for negotiation. And we probably all remember the videos of Harold Daggett, I forget the acronym for the East Coast dock workers, but he was like, we're striking. You know, he was like, we're going on strike. And so all of that sort of started shifting back to the West. Or there's been a lot of investment from Asia, some from China, from elsewhere, about establishing nodes in through Mexico. And so border industrial has been very popular among that. But of course, all of that's now, you know, basically hour by hour, you know, volatile. And so can you talk about what's going on with industrial as kind of this, you know, monolithic asset class? No, because there's all of these these sort of subcurrents that really drive leasing and capital flows to these areas. And, you know, to kind of stay on my soapbox, very hard to manage from a private capital allocation standpoint, much easier to manage from a public allocation standpoint. You have REITs like Rexford Industrial, which is focused exclusively on Southern California industrial. You have something like Plymouth, which takes a lot of the East Coast kind of up through the Midwest and things like that. So you can be a lot more tactical with how you're trying to understand a very, very dynamic world in that way.
And so what do you perceive in terms of that as the largest risk in the market? Are we looking at tariffs? Is that the largest risk to the industrial sector? Do you think it's issues of maybe overbuilding, which in some sections of the Chicagoland area on the larger boxes, I could make a case for that as well. What are you starting to see in the industrial market across the board as kind of some of your potential black swans?
Yeah, I think for industrial, the handful of big players, the Amazons of the world, really overinvested. And I remember talking with people that were in Amazon's real estate, and they were leasing like more space than they needed, putting up temporary walls that they were going to sort of grow into this space. And so I think one issue, and there's maybe some data on this, it's sparse, is that there's a lot more shadow supply of industrial out there than people believe there is. I do think that there's some green shoots in terms of kind of a renewed interest in industrial policy for kind of more flex industrial manufacturing, things like that. I think logistics is going to continue to be very volatile as we sort of work through a deglobalizing world. But that some of these other uses, kind of the flex manufacturing, industrial, things like that, could be big beneficiaries. And to the point about asset specificity, if you have a industrial property that was kind of tailor-made for logistics, it's very hard to transition that to something else. These are not just metal boxes. So I think kind of the risk is that even for something industrial, which again, I think people think of as a relatively quote-unquote simple asset class, this asset specificity and the nuances between geography and product type are going to become more and more pronounced. And I think that's something that happens those things become more pronounced in a downturn or in a softening market. On the way up, when cap rates are diving below 5%, if you can call it industrial, it's great. No one cares. But then when cap rates start rising and interest rates are higher, people actually start sharpening their pencil about what is this? And back to my original point, what am I actually exposed to here? What economic forces, what factors am I actually investing in here?
Yeah. Speaking of economic forces, one of the larger forces we've seen from our portfolio is the drive towards the increased valuation of small bay industrial. In terms of that, it's very hard in Chicagoland, generally in Illinois and Wisconsin and Indiana, to build small bay industrial. I think that's talking to most other investors. It's generally an issue across the board. And there's a lot of demand for kind of those fives and those tens. I'm curious how you see that playing out from the institutional world, because we haven't seen until at least the last maybe 18 months some of the institutions getting into small bay industrial. How are you seeing that play out from your perspective?
I think it is a very difficult space for institutional to play in because the tenant base is so fragmented. You're not negotiating with national tenants, you're negotiating with the local landscaping company. So I do think it's an area where private capital will probably continue to have an advantage, and especially local private capital will continue to have an advantage. I think it's a very hard asset class to not have a really strong understanding of your market. Now, with the disclosure that I've allocated to small bay industrial deals before, the sort of pitch versus reality is, a lot of the pitch is, hey, look, this is industrial. To your point, it's hard to build. hard to build a new supply of these. And look, your credit risk is spread across 20 tenants or 40 tenants instead of one or two, which is kind of true. But then you actually look at the rent roll, and they're all home service companies, or they're all contractors. And not only all contractors, they're all working on the same job. You know, they're all working on building the new Amazon logistics facility, or they're all working on building, you know, the new multifamily building. And so I think some of that perceived lower risk is actually higher risk. That, in fact, these facilities are all basically exposed to the same industry. And yeah, there's also kind of the qualitative side is like, all these guys are going to the same bar after work and you're not there. And they're all each other's creditor. And so if there is a downturn and those checks stop flowing, they're going to pay each other before they pay you. And so again, you know, this comes to that kind of like underrated risk. And back to my thing is like, what am I actually buying exposure to? Small bay industrial, you think you're buying exposure to home services primarily, that people are going to keep paying to have their grass cut and house painted and windows redone and all that. And that's not to me, that's not a certainty.
Yeah. I think in some sections of the small bay industrial world, I think that's definitely true. I know for us, our big exposure and what we've really focused on is machine shops, because that they tend to stay and they tend to be more resilient. But I 100% agree with contractors. Contractors do not like a recession. In terms of that, I wanted to go to something that's kind of seen as more recession-proof and or maybe not, and that's data centers. And you know, the risk reward there I think is tremendous. And one of the things that I think that we kind of struggle with is, as commercial real estate folks, is look, I have a law background, I have a commercial real estate background, I know how to code, but I'm not a tech guy. How do you perceive kind of the data center and the AI growth and kind of how it plays out in both the public and private real estate world?
Yeah. I mean, to your point, I remember, I think this was 2022. I went to the NAREIT conference and I decided to sit in the Equinix, which is one of the big data center operators sessions.
Yeah.
And it may have well as been in French. I mean, I had no idea what they were talking about. I've since gotten a little smarter on the space, but it's still very, very complex. I think that, you know, when we talk about one of the benefits, or I think one of the attractions to real estate, is that if you have an asset, provided it's in a good location, provided it meets, it can stay competitive for a very long time. And that's fundamentally, and particularly in this era, not the case with data centers. That what makes a data center competitive is constantly changing. The requirements to have a competitive data center for what the needs and where the demand is flowing is constantly moving around, and they require a lot of investment to stay competitive. There is, in fairness, a huge supply-demand imbalance right now. You know, the demand for these centers, especially as AI proliferates, and even as we move from what was training models, which took up a lot of space with hyperscalers, to let's say the cost comes way down and we're doing more inference, which is the actual application layer of using it, the location and requirements for those data centers is going to change. And there's still a huge, huge supply demand imbalance. That said, you know, kind of one of the first principles things about investing, I always keep in mind, is that the capital cycle spares no one. And there is so much capital coming into the space on the private side, on the CapEx from public companies, that it's very hard to accurately predict demand at any long duration. It's hard to look out 3 or 4 years and know what the demand for AI applications is going to be. It's hard to know what the demand for cloud computing is going to be in 3 or 4 years. But you can look at what's in pipeline now and have a very clear idea of where supply is going, and supply is going up. There is currently a supply-demand imbalance, but I think that's very tenuous, especially with all this capital coming into the space. I mean, the historical analog is fiber optic build out, you know, in the early 2000s. And it has so many of the same. No one was really wrong. Internet usage was increasing exponentially every year. More and more people were getting online, and everyone who built out fiber optic lost money because it was just too much supply. And it wasn't that the demand picture was wrong. It was just that when you flood any space with capital, returns go down. It's that simple. So I have not come up with a strong, I mean, on the REIT side, I don't particularly like data center REITs, but that's more of a structural issue, not like a macro thesis.
Can you go into that structural issue? Because I've heard you talk about this before, and I think it's a very unique insight into kind of some of the structural issues that can come with how public versus private can play out in a, like, in a heavily investment heavy space, right?
Exactly.
Which is unique, right?
Yeah. I mean, okay, so there's a debate. There's two sides of everything I'm going to say, and I'll try to present them both without sounding schizophrenic. You know, REITs have a mandated return of shareholder capital. It's one of the reasons I like them, is REITs have to pay out 90% of their net income. Now, because it's real estate, they have a big depreciation shield, but it still ends up being, for most REITs, around 50 or 60% of their cash flow gets returned to shareholders in the form of a dividend. For most real estate, this is a great structure because the reinvestment demands are relatively lower. And so a REIT goes through the year, they pay out half the cash flow to investors, and then they reinvest the other half of cash flows into new assets, into TIs to keep tenants happy, into whatever. The problem with that structure for data centers is twofold. One, as we talked about, it's a very capital intensive space to do CapEx to keep your facility up to date, requires a lot of cash. And then because of that mandated return of shareholder capital, you are pro-cyclically sending out the cash that you should be using to reinvest. So the more you make, the more you're sending out right at the time that you need to be reinvested in. When these data center REITs started taking re-election, I think I understand why they did it. It's because they wanted to get valued on a cash flow multiple, not on an earnings multiple. And a good way to do that is to take REIT election. Then people stop worrying about your earnings per share and start focusing more on your funds from operations and your cash flow. And I'm wondering if in time you're going to rue the day that they took REIT election for this very reason. Now, the other side of the argument for this is, yes, but because they're public, they have access to corporate level unsecured debt. They have access to equity issuance via the equity market. And so if you look at a private operator, they're having to do asset-backed debt. They're having to raise private capital, whereas an Equinix or a Digital Realty can do an aftermarket, raise $1 billion overnight from the public markets, go out to the fixed income market, raise corporate level unsecured debt, no problem. You know, so they have much better access to capital and lower cost of capital than do the private players at the moment. So you can't have it both ways. You can't have this sort of public markets pressure, but then you also will get the advantage of having kind of full access to capital markets.
Yeah. Look, I think that's a fascinating play, and see how it's going to actually play out in the market, right? I think we're in a very interesting time, particularly as, you know, Moore's Law accelerates and we start to get into this world where things are changing so quickly. I know that there's several players in our area that are looking at data centers and tying them into nuclear power plants and post decommission even nuclear power plants. And so I think we're in a world where there's going to be a lot of change over the next 5 years. And that's a space that I'm not going to play in. I'll say, I don't have enough capital and I don't understand nuclear physics enough to make a safe investment. So
anytime there's a new technology, which I think AI certainly qualifies as something novel and new in terms of our economic makeup, it's very hard at the outset to determine where the profit pools are going to float to.
Exactly.
Yeah. You know, and so for internet, you know, for broadband and high-speed internet, you know, it certainly didn't accrue to the Verizons and Comcast of the world that were kind of providing the rails for that technology. You know, it ultimately accrued to software providers and communications companies that were basically selling advertising, or, you know, subscription services, that software that ran on the cloud and things like that. And I don't think we have a really clear picture of where the profit pool for artificial intelligence is going to end up. It doesn't necessarily seem like it's going to be with the model builders. That's highly competitive. You know, I know that the $20 a month I pay for Claude is not covering the cost of providing me that service. I know that beyond a shadow of a doubt. So what does that mean for returns on invested capital in the space? I'm not really sure.
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of uncertainty there. One of the places that we also are seeing a lot of uncertainty and a space that I have played in and continue to play in is kind of both the public and private office REIT.
Yeah.
And so I'm curious, in a post-2020 world, like, what are you seeing in terms of, like, potential risk and then also potential reward playing out? Because that's a space where I think the risk-reward metric is actually pretty wide. And I'd be interested to see your perspective.
My view is that the office, as kind of a cultural institution in some form or another, is not going anywhere. I live in New York. I work for an asset manager. We have young analysts that are probably splitting like a 6-bedroom in Murray Hill. The office is the nicest place they go all week. Like, they're dying to get to the office. I think to quote Donald Rumsfeld, the known unknown for office is, what does the product look like to be competitive? I think there is a demand for workers to be in office. I think some of that demand comes from the workers. I think a lot of that demand comes from a giant layer of middle management whose only purpose is managing workers. So there's a lot of sort of social pressure to be in office. There's people whose their only job is to manage people. They need people in person to do that. But if you're going to ask people to come to the office, it needs to be a place that they want to go. And I think on the build out, on the TI side, on the floor plate side, on all of that, the known unknown is what in 2025, what makes an attractive office property? And I don't, you know, because you can get office at great, you know, the value investor to the degree there's any, you know, you're looking at offices trading at $80 a square foot, or, you know, $150 a square foot, whatever it is for the market. And you're like, it's got to work. But you don't know if it's another $200 of TI, or another $200 of CapEx to make it competitive. And so I think that's really the thing that we're, and someone will figure it out. Someone is going to figure out the formula that makes these offices competitive again. I think it's a huge opportunity for people that are thinking about that. And willing to step into that risk and sort of the creative challenge of, like, what does it take to fill this place up again? You know, a lot of New York landlords, certainly the New York REITs in the office space, have done a good job of this, I think. You know, the SL Greens of the world kind of saw the classic. New York is an interesting submarket. You know, if you're a white shoe law firm, you know, your office is a giant part of your brand. As a firm, it's why you can charge $1,000 an hour for legal work or whatever. And so here there was, you know, you could spend whatever on an office build out and basically lease it, you know, profitably because of that dynamic. Elsewhere in the market, you know, it's interesting. I think West Coast is a really interesting space right now. From an investment standpoint, from a capital allocation standpoint, I think this was one of those areas where REITs really shined in terms of the opportunity, because kind of maybe keep it, well, just keep it high level or not. You know, when you have a publicly traded equity, you know, think about a building, just to keep it simple, you've got your debt and you have your equity that sits below it. Well, for a REIT, the equity is publicly traded. So that means the loan to value that you as an investor are stepping into is constantly moving. And kind of at the nadir, at the like peak, office is dead, you could buy these office REITs at like 85, 90% implied LTV, you know, share price to enterprise value, you know. So it was an opportunity to step into a highly levered position in these offices that simply was not available in the private market. I mean, I don't know what your banker would have said if you had gone to him and said, I'd like to buy this office building, but I'd really prefer it to be, you know, around 90% LTV. They probably would have, you know, chased you out of the building. But those opportunities were available every day in the public markets.
I'll say this. We did buy some office space during the period, what was it, spring of 2021. And we bought it with cash because we investors are and I think you have to be, and the public private markets, I think you either have to be very well financed and very, very liquid to play in that game, or the REITs. They're also a very strong option. But you can't be, I don't think, a private investor who's playing in that space, who's getting financing from banks, because they just won't finance you in this world.
Right. That was a good opportunity to be opportunistic and look at these and say, look, I don't know whether it's going to work out or not, but I know that a 90% LTV position in some of these offices is not typically available.
Yes. So one of the things that's not typically available in the world is kind of real ideas about the future that are, I think, driven in reality. And we've been really trying to focus on looking at reality beyond perception. And one of the things that we love to do on this podcast is go to our final four and kind of understand a little bit more about you and a little bit more about where the world is going. So based on that reality versus perception world, where do you think commercial real estate is going over the next 10 years? And how can we kind of anticipate that change and try to maximize?
Yeah, this may be a bit of a cop-out, but I think that the asset class, whether it's from an operator perspective or an investor perspective, is going to continue to get much, much more data-driven, and that the data is going to improve and the ability to make data-driven decisions around real estate is going to greatly improve. You know, kind of controversy aside, the technology that something like a RealPage presents, you know, about being able to price an apartment basically perfectly, is going to permeate all sorts of asset classes. And, you know, the ability to value a lease, you know, a lease is this legal document that has a bunch of options embedded in it. And that I think in the next 10 years, we're going to have the data and the technology to actually value each of those options in the lease and come up with a true, you know, much sharper. I think the real estate market's going to continue on its path towards kind of like greater and greater efficiency. You know, there's already a degree of which, like if you're a property owner that has any kind of investable asset, you know, your phone, you get an appraisal 30 times a day, people calling you, telling you what they'll pay for your property. That is going to like start to permeate out, and we're just going to have much better information about values, about how to build property, about what makes things competitive, and what these kind of all these little options and optionality in real estate are worth.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of truth to that. I know that's something that we've had individuals that run companies that are data based on this platform before and on this podcast. I think the big question that I'm interested in, and I'd like to ask you on this, is how do you think we're going to be able to gather all that data? Because I think the biggest gap that I see both with public and private markets is data is very siloed. Are you seeing a path that, from your perspective in New York, that there are more people that are interested in compiling data together to gain that systems benefit, or do you think we're going to see large silo databases and kind of the person with the largest silo might be the most advantageous?
Yeah, so that's the world we live in now, is the silo database, where, you know, it's CoStar, let's say they've invested a lot of money of people like doing really, you know, they pull in some publicly available data and some semi-public data, but then a lot of their product is just hitting the phones. And that's because to this point, all of the information has been very like property driven. What's this? I want this address. But I think to get better data, we're going to move to kind of an anonymized get-give relationship. I'm gonna hand you over everything I have. It's going to be anonymized to a degree, but you're going to be able to extract insights from it. And by giving you that, then I'm going to be able to get those insights back. You know, there's this great kind of curve of data where there is the production of data. And to use like a financial markets, like the exchanges, they have a monopoly on data production. They see what prices are trading at. Then there's distribution of data. And this is where like a CoStar exists. They take all this data and they distribute it. But then the really high value data businesses, the highest value data businesses are in the activation of data. S&P, yes. Moody's, things like that. Things that create credit ratings, indices, and other data products that aren't in the information production business, they're not in the distribution business, they're in the activation business. And I don't think real estate has gotten that activation layer yet.
Yeah.
You know, the future of real estate data is not just like a slightly better UX to log into. Like, it's going to be an analytic. It's going to be some novel IP that actually is able to drive decision making.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think it's going to be a big risk, though, for whoever does come up with that, because CoStar and Crexy and LoopNet and whatever, and they all just love hitting the phones. And I think someone's going to have to take a real leap of faith to get there. In terms of taking a leap of faith, I wanted to go and take a leap back. We all take leaps of faith at the beginning of our careers. I'm curious if you could give advice to a young hunter, what would that advice have been?
Yeah, I think this is something that I'm 36, and it's really, I think, been the past. Maybe it's a post-COVID thing, you know, the realization or going through that experience or whatever. But from an investment standpoint, when you're young, and you're new into the industry, there's this huge focus on like technical proficiency. How well can you model? How well can you understand the balance sheet? How well can you sort of like, you know, pick up on the terms and the patois of the industry and like be able to talk about it? And those are undeniably important skills, but the difference between somebody that's at the 80th and 90th percentile is not that much value add. Or even the 70th and 90th percentile. It just doesn't make that big a difference. The thing that makes people great investors, great capital allocators, is people who know how to nurture their curiosity and people that are willing to have and articulate a differentiated view of the future. And you kind of constantly need to be keeping that in the forefront of your mind, that the way this works, you know, there's a great quote, I think it's unattributed, but it says, you know, investing is about having the market agree with me later. Like, you need to have a view that's sufficiently differentiated from everyone else for this to work. And if you're not kind of coming back to that keystone, I was like, what do I think that everyone does it? It's very hard to, you end up just chasing momentum. You know, if I come to somebody and tell them, my 3-year-old probably knows that the demand for AI is outpacing the supply of data centers at that point. There really be that much alpha left in that theme.
Yeah.
You know, so I think that's one thing I wish I had realized a lot earlier. These technical skills are important, but what really makes someone a great investor is someone who's sort of relentlessly curious and willing to form, just a vision of the future that people haven't thought of yet.
Look, I think that's phenomenal advice. In terms of, that's one of the whole reasons why we started this podcast, and we talk to people across a wide spectrum of real estate backgrounds, everyone from trailer parks to data centers to people involved in REITs. So in terms of that, one of the ways that we like to also expand our mind is books on real estate. And so I'm curious if you have a book suggestion that someone should pick up.
I'm hesitant to suggest this one because it's definitely not going to be everyone's cup of tea.
That's totally fine.
There's a book called The Aggressive Conservative Investor. It's written by Marty Whitman, who has since passed, but he's my favorite investor of all time. And as kind of the paradoxical title would suggest, to me, it's a very novel way of looking at investing that I had not, you know, if you come up in investing, like, you know, you read the Buffett letters, you read this sort of like, you read the tomes that define the genre of value investing. And value investing extends to whether that's public equities or real estate or whatever. It's not a, you know, it's a mindset that I'm going to buy something below the price it's really worth. But when I read that stuff, it just did not resonate with me the way it did with everybody else. And then someone pointed me to Marty Whitman, and I was like, this is it. This makes sense. And I think the biggest difference between Whitman and what a lot of other people teach about investing and why it's so applicable to real estate is because Whitman focused so much on the balance sheet. Most investors are myopically focused on the income statement. That's true whether it's real estate or Google. You know, how much money are they going to make? What are revenues going to be? What's rent going to be? And what Whitman realized was that far, far more value is created on what he called asset conversion activities, refinances, sales, purchases, mergers, acquisitions, that's where way more shareholder value gets created than just in driving bottom line earnings. And that's so true of real estate. Most people make their money in real estate refinancing the property, not from the rent it costs. And so developing this kind of like balance sheet mindset for everything has been really kind of transformative in how I look at the world.
Look, I think that's phenomenal advice. I had never heard of him before. And that's something that I know we've really focused on here is trying to maximize value in terms of refinancing. And certainly during the period in 2021 to 2022 before the markets corrected some of their liquidity allocations. That was a hugely profitable point for our business. One of the things though that we find a tremendous amount of intellectual profit from is reaching out to the men and women in the arena to try to go and reach out to the best voices in the industry. And we're a firm believer in that. The folks that are involved know who the next person should be that we reach out to, or at least reach out to some point in the future. I'm curious, who's the next individual in real estate or at least real estate adjacent that we should reach out to?
So if you haven't been able to pick up by my like general themes, is that I'm like not a venture capital futurist type. You know, I'm like very.
That's okay. We know plenty of them. That's not
so. So like my recommendation is to talk to my friend Brad Hargraves. He writes the Thesis Driven newsletter, and Brad is a great person to like hang out and talk with for me because he's so future focused, and so he's thinking about things that have not even come into my field of view.
Like that sounds awesome. Yeah.
Even enter, you know, he's on this big thing that, you know, autonomous driving is going to change the shape of the real estate market tremendously. Now, I haven't even developed a view on that, but it's certainly nothing that, you know, and I just gave you the advice to have a differentiated view of the future. And so talking to people like Brad kind of helps me like exercise that muscle a little bit.
Yeah.
He's like kind of on the far end of that. And so I think he'd be a great person to talk to. And he comes from this very sort of, with a real estate grounding, very future-focused view of how things are going to be.
Well, we would love to get a connection from you. But there's one final question that we have to ask before we wrap up. And it's, if somebody wants to reach out to you, what's the best way to get in contact?
The best way to get in contact with me would probably be through my Substack, which I've got my email and the best ways to get in touch with me on there. And on that, I write about kind of a lot of the things we talked about today, REITs in the asset management industry. And so that's lewisenterprises.blog is my Substack, and would love to have people come and reach out to me there. So find me there.
But we'll put all that information in the comments. And thank you so much for hopping on the podcast today. We really appreciate it. And we have to have you on in the future.
Yeah, I would love to. Thank you so much, Wade.
Thanks again to Hunter. We appreciate his insights. And if you enjoyed the podcast, please give us a like, a 5-star rating, and a review. Your comments, interactions, and subscriptions truly matter and help us continue to get quality guests. You can find us on YouTube, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gordon Lanfear with the Real Finds Podcast. Thank you for listening.